I realized what was happening. Robbie was about to fix a case with a judge we'd heard nothing about. There was precious little small talk.
"Come here, you," Robbie said.
You could hear him shuffle nearer. The springs in her chair sang out. There was a coarse rubbing of clothing, and to my astonishment, Magda Medzig emitted a rapturous little groan. I knew for sure I'd guessed wrong when he told her she had the greatest tits in the world. Things progressed rapidly to the usual percussion accompanying the human animal in heat. Zippers, shoes hitting the floor, exerted breathing. Robbie and the judge eventually moved away from the phone to a sofa, I imagined. But their sounds remained telling. Magda was a groaner. As it developed, she was also wildly amused when Robbie employed certain Anglo-Saxon words. He could not have made a more explicit recording if it were a travelogue. As he described his forthcoming activities, unbounded laughter spilled from her. Big pink cunt. Big hard cock. The running brook of Magda's happy sounds was the only element that kept this from feeling entirely like a peep show. "Enough?" asked Stan.
"Plenty," I said.
Clucker had his fingers over his mouth, but he jiggled with laughter. McManus, on the other hand, had turned away from the speakers as soon as the tape rolled. He spent most of the time staring at his thumb.
"So?" asked Sennett.
"Odometer on his zipper," I reminded Stan. "I didn't say the big deal." "You know the definition of bribery, George? A benefit of any kind intended to influence the action of a public official?" I actually laughed at him. Prosecutors. Robbie sounded like the beneficiary to me. "The lady on that tape isn't going to launch 1,000 ships, George." "And he's not picky," I reminded Stan. "Look, George, you say what you like. Moira Winchell didn't have any problem signing the warrant." Stan had been playing on home court. Chief Judge Winchell, frosty and officious, would have been scandalized by this, especially as a woman entrusted with similar power. But I couldn't believe Sennett would actually prosecute, and I told him so. "I don't know what I'll do, George, but I do know this much." With gunslinger eyes, Stan leaned over the Parsons-like conference table. "Your guy's holding out on us. He's banging the lady judge and then appearing before her on motions, on which he has a stellar rate of success, I might add. I want to know what else he's holding back. I haven't gone to D.C. with this yet, and you know full well I don't want to have to roll the project up. I'd like to present this as additional information developed in the course of the investigation. But I can only do that little dance step once. Next time they'll shut us down and cart Robbie off to do 40 to 52 months. So this is it, George. Amnesty Day at the library. I want all the books open and on the table." I sat in one of the leatherette swivel chairs, confounded. I was long hardened to the dumb things clients would do. I was unsettled, rather, by a legal conundrum. No matter how supportive Chief Judge Winchell was, the law required probable cause, reliable evidence portending this supposedly corrupt encounter before a bug could be authorized. Where had that proof come from? I asked Stan, and regretted it promptly as he simpered. "You're supposed to be wondering that privately, George. The government's response to the question is none of your business. But I warned you. I told you we'd know." I groaned when the answer struck me. They'd bugged Robbie, too. Sennett was utterly stoic when I ventured this thought. He strolled to the electronic equipment in the cabinets and looked it over astutely, like a buyer in a showroom. I told Stan this was too low. To make a deal with a guy and then undermine him, whatever the madmen at UCork were demanding. But it was a mistake, being so direct with Stan, given our audience. The personal side of our relationship had not really been exhibited to the agents. Sennett felt required to defend himself, particularly because McManus's continuing silence telegraphed a deep uneasiness with present events.
George, Sennett said, you may like this guy, but to me he's a Trojan horse with a body recorder, that's all. He might as well be a robot. I need two things to win these cases. Dead bang recordings and proof that the government held him to his bargain and didn't let him just bag the judges he hates. If a jury thinks that happened, then they may well cut everybody loose rather than let a creep like Robbie play favorites. And frankly, from what I hear, that seems like it's happened. But bugging him? I insisted. A deal to cooperate doesn't authorize this kind of gross intrusion into his private life. We're legal, Stan shot back. Like every prosecutor, he resented the suggestion of abuse. We're completely legal. That's all I'll say. He bulleted me with one more angry, dark look and put on his coat, which had been slung over a chair. No, I'll say something else, George, because I resent your sanctimony. Your beloved client is what people have in mind when they use the word lawyer as a pejorative. He treated a profession which you and I are both proud to be a part of as if it's tantamount to pimping. And he got rich doing it. And when we caught him, he made a deal to tell us the whole truth and nothing but, a deal which he doesn't seem to be living up to. And you and he both better understand that I'll do whatever I have to within the limit of the law to protect these prosecutions. Because I have to, George. Because the people on the other side, your clients, buddies, the Brendans, the Kosicks, they're a law unto themselves. For them, there are no limits. These are ruthless men, George. My friend Stan Sennett stared from the door, his eyes now hidden in the shadow of his snap-brim hat. He was pointing at me, a gesture meant to indicate he had no present use for courtesy or any of my other pretenses. And if I'm not willing to be as tough as they are, to seize every advantage allowed, if I'm not willing to do that, something terrible will happen, George. They'll walk away, and they'll do all of this again and again. They'll win, George, and we'll lose, you and me, and the profession we're proud of. He looked back from the threshold, and I don't want to lose. Favor paced in my office and raged. Is that corrupt? He asked. Letting a lonely woman have a little affection? According to the recording, I offered. It wasn't so little. The locker room humor, an effort to soothe him, drew a fleet smile, but he barely changed stride. So I'm a jocker. So what? This is a lady, a person, for Christ's sake. She's a great person. You think she was looking for this? I was whispering sweet nothings in her ear for years. Do you know who Magda is? She was a novice. She lived in a convent until she was 19. She's still in an apartment with her 88-year-old mother. And we fuck in her chambers because she'd rather die than be seen coming out of a hotel room with a man. This lady, George, didn't have sex with anybody until she was 40, and then just because she couldn't stand thinking of herself as a virgin. So she got keel-hauled and let the super in her building have at her one day while Mom's visiting an aunt. Quite a story. This guy wooing her a mile a minute in Polish, not a word of which she happens to speak, and smelling, so she says, a little European. And then, of course, she was so embarrassed she moved out the next month. I mean, she's pretty goddamn funny about it. Did you know Magda was funny?
I'd had a 4-week trial in front of Judge Medzik when she sat in the felony division, and I didn't remember a moment that warranted more than a momentary smile. She had good demeanor and better than average ability. But for Robbie's purposes and mine, there was only one thing about her that mattered. She was a judge, before whom he had appeared often over the years.
I like Magda, for Christ's sake. I really like her. We have a great time together. I'd like her whether she ruled for me or not. And she doesn't rule for me all the time. I get this little tiny smile and a shrug when it goes the wrong way, like, what can I do? This is my job.
She had no business ruling either way, not in these circumstances. It was shame, I could see, that had been her undoing. She hadn't recused herself from Favor's cases because she would have expired if she were ever called upon to explain the reasons to the presiding judge.
So they're going to put her in the penitentiary for getting laid?
Probably not.
There was no mention of any case on the tape I'd heard, and Robbie insisted there never had been. But that didn't obscure Sennett's larger message that Robbie was not entitled to pick and choose whom he'd talk about.
Who would they be holding out on?
He asked.
Really?
Mort was my first answer.
Robbie jolted. I'd scared him, or caught him, perhaps both. My continuing worry was that Sennett and I would someday be having a heart-to-heart, much like today's, but one where it was Morty on the tape, up to his ears in all of this. I told Robbie that the train was leaving the station. Anything that should be said about Mort or anyone else had to be heard now. He insisted, as always, that Mort was clean.
Don't you believe me?
His dark face was a beacon of baptismal innocence. Conveniently, my phone rang. Even before summoning Robbie, I'd called a private investigator named Lorenzo Cotrar, whom I'd represented some years before when he was charged with violating the federal wiretapping statute. Poor Lorenzo had gotten the goods on his client's cheating husband, a police captain, but the captain took more than his pound of flesh when Lorenzo went off to the federal correction institution at Sandstone for 16 months. When Lowe was released, he found the notoriety of his case had led to significant demand for his technical expertise. He now worked the other side of the street, so to speak, sweeping and debugging, usually for major corporations, but also for persons wary of snooping by spouses and partners, not to mention the government. He was calling from Robbie's office, to which Favor had admitted him before coming to see me.
"It's clean," Lowe told me.
But he could not say that Sennett hadn't shut down, anticipating the sweep. Klecker had had such free access to the line cabinet in the building that it might have been no more than a matter of throwing a switch. Lowe offered to do Robbie's car and house next, but Favor was certain his two calls to Magda had come from the office. I looked out to the river below, where the city lights swam on the currents. It remained possible that Sennett had tapped Magda's chambers for other reasons. Perhaps Robbie had wandered into a trap set for someone else. But he found that idea laughable. Magda's a quality person. She wouldn't even know how to be a crook.
So where?
I asked. Where did Stan get probable cause for the bug? Favor's black eyes were still. But if he knew, he wasn't telling me. Chapter 18. McManus phoned even at home that night. He had never done that before, and he stayed with the cover, telling her he hadn't received a copy of Favor's brief in a case in which his reply was due the next day. He insisted, cordially but firmly, that she bring it to his office right now. He unlocked the door himself. Past 8 p.m., the LeSueur building had a ghost town feeling. A cleaning man ran a floor buffer down the corridor, but aside from the security guards, he was the only person she'd seen about. Somewhere, young lawyers were toiling, but they were confined like secrets, given away only by the occasional scattered lights visible from the street. McManus told her the story in bold strokes. Her heart rippled at one point when she thought he was about to play her the tape, but Jim proved too old-fashioned for that. Shame was her predominant reaction anyway. It felt as if someone had poured battery acid into her veins. She had been placed in Favor's office to prevent or detect episodes exactly like this. "So I look real good on this thing," she said, when Jim finished. From experience, she'd have expected something forgiving from McManus, his usual faint, silent smile. But his light eyes were still as he studied her. Jim had his tie down, his sleeves rolled. Two cartons of Chinese were at the end of the long conference table, one of them emitting an overpowering odor of garlic.
"And you had no clue on this?" he asked.
"No idea about this judge?" Klong was the agent term.
The rush of shit to the heart when you suddenly saw you'd screwed up. Sure, she knew. There was that remark about messing around with a judge which Favor had made after the first time they'd seen Walter.
Anybody else hear about that?
McManus asked. He was fully focused, intent. She drummed her fingers. She had told Alf, who had a persistent, lurid curiosity concerning Robbie's catting about.
Alf?
McManus looked to the fake grain of the conference table as he pondered. Behind the steel door, the night sounds of the city were held at astonishing distance.
Somebody backdoored me on this, Jim finally said. Alf must have let it slip,
maybe to the local agents on the surveillance, but Sennett knew, and he went around me. He handed me a signed warrant on Friday morning, told me to get Alf to do the installation. No details. He must have used the IRS guys to nail down the probable cause. I didn't understand what he was ticked about.
McManus flexed his hand, on which the fingers were slightly clubbed. His usual comfortable manner had worn down. If he was from D.C., and his comments over the weeks had largely confirmed that, he'd been through this before. You ran with the big dogs in that town, got crackbacked and bushwhacked and cut down at the knees.
Still, it wasn't Jim.
He was sending us a message, Jim said. Me and you, about staying on our toes. He wants you inside this guy's shirt from now on. He already said as much. You're with him whenever he leaves home. Her impulse, as always, was to defend herself. Robbie had made it sound as if the relationship was long over.
Then learn the lesson.
Anything like this in the future? Some mention of other judges? Any hints? You better let me know. The rebuke was mildly spoken, but it burned through her. And when he starts talking, McManus weighed what he was saying. You've got to try to draw him out. More. See if you can. God knows what else there might be like this.
More.
Eva nearly laughed. More, and she'd need to borrow a couch from a shrink or somebody's wetsuit. But McManus's expression allowed no room for humor. Jim's mouth worked around what he was going to say next. This isn't the nicest part, he said, and looked at her directly so she didn't miss the meaning. She considered the advice in the strange hush of the building and tried not to shake her head.
It's not easy, Jim said. UC is the hardest.
And you know, Favor...
Jim shrugged.
I've sort of gotten to like the guy.
In his way.
In his way,
she agreed.
McManus smiled.
I like him.
He checked himself there and gave his head and his boyish due the tiniest shake. There was a leased car for her in the basement garage, McManus told her. She'd see Favor in and out the door to his house every day now. As she drove home, she felt her emotions collecting in a familiar way, sliding into humiliation. She felt hammered down by it, more ponderously now that she was alone. When it came back up again, by the time she'd closed the deadbolt inside her apartment, it had made its inevitable transformation to anger, her ferocious companion.
She'd been played! Played by Robert S. Favor, future felon and full-time slimeball.
She was even enraged with McManus, who was doing what bosses do in bad situations, sending her in two different directions at once, asking her to be warier at the same time she was supposed to lead the guy along. They had the wrong girl for that. There wasn't that kind of art to her. If she didn't respect McManus so much, she'd have told him so.
Fucking Sennert!
She said aloud. Game player, power monger.
I hate that shit.
Playing the Mormon girl, she'd reverted for months to the vocabulary she'd used in high school. The curse words resounding around the apartment struck her as childishly amusing. Fucking Sennett. She laughed then. She'd just realized what it was McManus was going to say,
about favor at the end. He was going to say, "I like him more than Stan." At 6 a.m., she was parked outside Favor's house, blocking the driveway. He didn't ask why. He knew it was coming. For cover, though, they'd still travel in the Mercedes. Settling in, she slammed the door with a powerful heave. He did not look her way as she frumped around in the seat. "I'm going to be out here every morning now, bucko, and I'm going to be seeing your wandering behind through the door every night, and I'm calling every 2 hours to make sure you've stayed put. I'm even tying a string around your ankle when you go to the potty." He flirted with a smile, then apparently reconsidered under the circumstances. "Do you have just the smallest clue how bad you made me look?" she asked. When he turned, his expression, its harshness, was shocking. "Cut the crap. I know you dimed me out on this. I know you went right to Senate when I said I'd had a thing with a judge." "I only wish I had, Robbie. Did you listen in on my phone calls, too?" "Sure," she said. "Absolutely. I record them on that wire I'm wearing. Senate's up all night listening to the output." They were driving. There'd been a frost again last night, and the windshields of the cars at the curbs were glazed with what looked like large snowflakes. He made a bitter remark. Everything with her was business. "You're not going to do this," she said. "You're not going to embarrass the hell out of me and then try to make me feel bad because you got caught with your hand in the cookie jar. You're not going to do that, Favor." "Hey, I'm a big boy. I took a chance and I lost." She battled herself. He was always saved by intuition. Because, of course, there was a piece of her that inevitably needed to explain. "You barefaced lied to me and now you want an apology? Lied? Didn't you tell me that you'd stop that stuff? Oh, please. Didn't you? What was it you said? It seems disloyal? He'd be single again soon enough." She skipped that part out of sheer mercy. "What's it to you? Only my job, that's all. Just what I get up every morning to do. I'm lying in bed last night, ripping the hell out of myself. How'd you miss it? Then I realized you'd looked right in my dumb green eyes and told me that, whopper. You didn't believe it anyway. Stop making excuses, damn it. What kind of person are you? How can you just flat out say stuff that isn't true, that you know isn't true? Ah, don't give me that production number. Men were deceivers ever. Shakespeare, right? Everybody lies. Oh, I love your hair. What a great idea. The dog ate my homework. Jesus Christ, every minute you're living is a lie. Look at you. My name is Evan Miller. I'm a Mormon girl from Idaho. But that's for a reason, for a good reason. So I had a good reason, too. Yeah, fooling around and getting favorable rulings." He tried to speak, then stopped. His hands moved first. "Listen. You know, when I went romping around up on the stage, I always felt like I was trying on things about myself, little pieces of myself, seeing if they could be ginned around to fit, like making stained glass. You can call me a liar, and people do, but at least I've tried. I haven't sat around with the same Looney Tune fantasies as everybody else, keeping them in some hot, dark box until they start to stink. If you talk, if you tell, if you make the play, if you say, 'That's who I am,' at least it gives you the chance to figure out if you're right." She thought of a million old sayings. So full of it, his eyes were brown. "And who did you think you were trying to be by BSing me?" His Adam's apple wobbled. "Somebody you liked." She didn't say anything. He was an actor, she reminded herself. An actor. At a stoplight, a woman in the next car was making up her face, sharpening her brows at the moment as she hiked herself up to the rear view to peek at the results. They drove on quite some time without speaking, the morning burble of two high-powered drive-time jocks filling the car, the pair yelling at each other to revive their audience. "So, did you listen to it?" he asked. She just slid her eyes over. He knew the look by now. "Oh, come on, fess up. I know you listened to that tape." They went through that a couple of times, each run-through stoking her anger again.
"Why would I care?"
she asked him.
"'Cause you've got this burning interest in my scintillating personal life."
"Me?"
"Oh, come on, that's all you want to talk to me about, almost from day one."
He went down a list he'd apparently been keeping, beginning with the girl with the flag. He didn't mention the other day when she'd frisked him, but it was clear the incident had emboldened him. By the time he finished, she could barely hear over the blood rush throbbing in her ears.
"Oh, boy. Here we go again. What do they call this? A recurring theme? I just can't resist you."
"You're curious about something.
Drop dead."
She said it as if she meant it, which she did. Instead, he repeated himself. She was curious.
"You know, Favor, you ain't as smart by half as you think you are. I thought you told me you had the picture. When you gave me your big lecture about Shaheen, whatever her name is, who you kissed on stage, I thought you said you had me all figured."
A little voice within asked what in the Lord's name she was doing. But it was the stuff with McManus. The only way she could translate it was just to let fly. In spite of traffic, he'd turned full about to look at her. She did not shy away, just let the anger burn from her eyes. For the moment, she had him confounded, not because he didn't remember, but because he couldn't get the words out of his mouth.
"I never said that," he insisted.
"The hell?"
"They didn't. Well, what if I said you were right? What would you say, smarty pants?"
He took an awfully long time.
"You dig girls?
What would you say?" He drove in silence, but she could tell he was thinking. His eyes seemed to have shrunk back some infinitesimal measure into his face.
"I'd say, good."
"Good."
"Yeah,"
he said, and finally cheated a glance her way.
"I'd say we have something in common." "You know, I know that was just a line. Yesterday, about you being a..."
She arched an eyebrow, awaiting the slur. They were in the Mercedes on their way to work.
"What should I say?"
he asked.
"Sapphist?"
"Lesbian seems to be the word if you're straight."
"But you're not, are you?"
"Straight?"
"Not straight." "Look, whatever I am is none of your business."
"So why'd you tell me?" She'd been contemplating that for a day. She'd needed to knock him off his high horse to regain some control, let him know he didn't have her completely pegged. But whenever her mind lit on what she'd said, she wanted to crawl away.
"I think it's a play," he said.
She told him to think what he wanted, but she couldn't settle for that. After a moment, she pivoted on the smooth leather of the passenger seat.
"It's just a hoot. I'm telling you things, my lord, saying things to you I haven't told my sisters. And you're sitting there going, prove it. What do you want me to do, describe my first time?"
He actually seemed to consider that.
"You know I've done that," he said, a block or two farther on. "Said I was that way. Inverted, isn't that the word?"
"You said you were gay?"
"Yeah, I did. I did it a lot, as a play."
"Naturally," she said dryly.
"What does that mean?"
"Forget about it."
"You think I'm always on the play, right?"
"Look, just tell me the story. That's what you're going to do anyway, isn't it? You think I'm giving you a line about being a lesbian and you'll prove it by telling me how you've said you're gay, which, of course, is a play because nobody could ever believe that about you."
He stared at her for some time. They had just pulled into the garage at the Le Sueur, and he slammed the car into park. God, where did that come from? She was mean. She could hear her mother's voice clearly delivering that judgment. She was mean. She grabbed his wrist.
"Look, tell me the story."
"Another time," he said. He patted his muffler into place, inspecting himself in the vanity mirror on the visor as he prepared to present himself to the public in the lobby of the Le Sueur.
"Okay, be like that."
"Look, it's not a big deal.
I told you it was a play. You're going to hate me for it anyway.
Then I'll try to forgive you, she said.
Her mother had always said that forgiveness was a virtue. He took the chance of looking her way to see if she meant it before he stared out the windshield into the murky reaches of the garage.
It was just in college, all right? It was a line. I'd tell girls that. You know, that I was having a crisis, that I thought I was that way, that I was really worried about it. And in those days, they'd be horrified. For my sake, you know, they'd say, no, not you. You can't be that way. Have you ever done anything? No, no, I'd say. But I just worry about it sometimes.
Look, it was the dark ages. Nobody ever talked out loud about this stuff. It probably sounds ridiculous now, but to an 18-year-old girl from Great Neck, it was pretty convincing. And you realize what the point was, right? You know what I was really after.
And it worked. Girls fell for it.
All the time. They were always so proud of me afterwards. Even girls I never called again didn't mind. It was our little secret that they'd sort of healed the leper. I guess I shouldn't laugh, right?
Right. She looked away.
You said you'd forgive me.
She'd said she'd forgive him.
Her mother, who preached that lesson, seldom seemed to forgive her. Some woeful guttural escaped her. Every time she sat her large pink fanny down in this automobile, something went awry.
Who cares? She asked.
I forgive you, you forgive me. Who we kidding? You're just talking dirty and I'm letting you do it.
It's not dirty.
No, what is it? He took a moment.
It's friends, isn't it?
Aren't we? We're talking like friends, that's all.
Friends. She couldn't believe it. She felt the weight of him watching her.
So, do they know? He asked.
They who?
Your bosses, headquarters, whoever's on the Homo Patrol now that they miss J. Edgar Hoover. She could see how this was going to turn out. A cataclysm. It was never going to end. She refused to answer.
I thought that was an issue, he said. They don't want anybody blackmailed.
Are you threatening me?
No, God, no.
You're threatening me.
I tell you I'm a lesbian. Hey, he said, I don't care if you say I'm a little teapot. That stays here. I don't rat my friends even, no matter what. That's why everybody was on my case yesterday.
She wondered what Walter Wunsch or Barnett Skolnick would say about that. This guy would never make sense.
I was just thinking, he said. As he paused, a little ironic wiggle flexed through his even features.
She knew what was coming. Something of dubious taste, surely insulting. Something that would treat her life like a dirty joke.
Don't you dare, she told him.
She popped the door lock on her side.
No,
he reached after her. No,
I just realized.
What?
What could he possibly have realized? You're always undercover.
April. Chapter 19. At the time I met Sherm Crowthers, I was a young state defender and he was one of the stars of the criminal defense bar. Throughout my career, there have always been gifted black men renowned in court, great orators who borrow from the style of Baptist preachers. But Crowthers was unique. He was a stone fortress of a human being, nearly 6'6". His huge proportions had paved the way for a college scholarship to State, where he became a legendary football star in the 50s. After he had literally knocked down a wooden goalpost while catching a touchdown pass, he had acquired the nickname Sherman in reference to the tank, and I seldom heard anyone call him Abner, which was his given name. His size was also the foundation of a uniquely imposing personality. In court, he was seldom anything but belligerent. He terrified witnesses, including cops, treated judges with disdain, and did not even spare juries. He attempted charm in the early phases of a trial,
but in summation he worked himself into a state of absolute fury in which he delivered virtual orders to the jurors, which, to the chagrin of the prosecution, were all too often followed. Sherm was brilliant, but it was the aggressive character of his mind that especially impressed me. He was never back on his heels. He accused and quarreled and ridiculed and rarely met any argument head-on. His accent was still strongly flavored with South Georgia, where he'd been a shoeless boy, but it was no drawl. He spoke at bullet speed, never quite getting to the end of words before another thought was coming at you, the better to batter you down. In my early days, I tried one case with him as co-counsel. I was scared of him throughout, just like everybody else I knew. Our clients were charged in a dice game murder. Sherm's guy had been cheated, and my client's prints were on the gun. Their defense was that the murder weapon had actually been drawn by the victim, whom they said had been killed as they attempted to wrest the .38 from him. The onlookers didn't seem to remember it that way, although they admitted things had happened quickly. But the pathological evidence appeared to show that the gun had been fired from at least 3 feet. Sherm's cross of the police pathologist, Dr. Russell, was astonishing. He took the murder weapon and loaded it while Russell was on the stand, cleared the chamber, then put the weapon in the pathologist's hand and forced it back toward his face, engaged all the while in a barrage of questions about the physiology of wrists and fingers. As the gun lingered at his temple, Russell's voice grew watery and he appeared to have no confidence whatsoever in his opinions. Afterwards, the chief state defender asked me what I'd learned from the experience of trying a case with the legendary Sherm Crowthers. The answer was nothing. He was inimitable. It was hard to convince anyone that I'd actually seen a defense lawyer point a loaded gun at a witness during cross-examination, much less that the judge and the prosecutors never thought to object. Nevertheless, the case left me with much to ponder. Sherm saw life in terms of angry essentials, inescapable categories, rich and poor, black and white, which, as far as he was concerned, defined everything, and whose existence enraged him. Even worse, in his view, was the hypocrisy practiced by virtually everyone but him in refusing to acknowledge the all-determining power of these factors. When the jury went out, I was astounded that Sherm had no doubt they'd acquit.
"We gonna win this case, don't you know that? No problem here, 'cause it's just a nigger shooting a nigger. Happens every day. We gave that jury all the excuse they need. This here was just some drunks at a dice game, not somebody gonna bust into their house. They don't care now. This isn't gonna take 2 hours before they send these two fellas home. Don't give a hoot if they get drunk and shoot another nigger or two tonight."
Sherm was huge in every part, with a massive face, a long, wide brow, and large, throbbing eyes. His hatred for a moment stood magnified in all of his dark features. He despised me, not so much for being white as for not seeing what was plain to him. And the jury returned a not guilty verdict in about 90 minutes. When he was nominated for the bench, I was astounded. Sherm lived the black bourgeois life, not a lot different from Robbie's. Big cars, diamonds, snappy clothes, and I couldn't imagine him enjoying anything in the law more than combat in the courtroom. Furthermore, every lawyer I knew, black or white, was terrified of facing Sherman on the bench. In the Bar Association, there was a restless current of opposition. But it was the early 80s. The dispossessed African-American electorate was demanding more black hands on the levers of power, and no one could doubt Sherm's abilities. As my friend Clifton Baring, probably the county's most respected black politician, told me,
"He's a son of a bitch, George, but he's the son of a bitch we all need."
The two contrived cases Robbie had in front of Crowthers, one assigned to him directly, the other transferred from Judge Sullivan, had dawdled along. The first of the cases, King v. Hardwick, was supposedly a sexual harassment suit whose plot Robbie had dreamed up, apparently inspired by the story he'd later told about Constanza's daughter and her ex-boyfriend. In this version, a young woman, whom we called Olivia King, had been secretary to Royce Hardwick, an executive at Foreland Supply, who was 2 decades her senior. In her first year of employment, she and Hardwick had had a brief fling. Eventually, she met a man closer to her own age and broke off the relationship, enraging Hardwick. His wounded antics, ranging from pitiful entreaties to furious ridicule, had forced her to quit her job. Even then, Hardwick persisted. He followed her to work, harassed her by phone, and sent silly, defamatory letters to her new boss, which, while unsigned, were clearly from him. Finally, in desperation, Olivia had contacted a female superior of Hardwick's. An investigation was initiated in which a company attorney interviewed him. Hardwick casually admitted virtually everything Olivia claimed, laughing it off as a prank. He was astonished when the company fired him. Now that Olivia had brought suit, Hardwick's story had changed. He defended with a mixture of outright denial and failed recollection, explaining objective evidence like phone records and Olivia's co-workers' sightings of him lurking around the elevators as simply part of his efforts to retrieve needed information from his departed secretary. As for Hardwick's confession to the company attorney, his present lawyer, James McManus, asserted that it could not be admitted into evidence because of the attorney-client privilege. The central question in determining whether the interview was privileged was whether Hardwick could have reasonably believed Foreland's lawyer was acting in his behalf rather than for the company. On April Fool's Day, Robbie and McManus appeared before the Honorable Judge Crowthers to argue the issue. As a judge, whatever else might be said against him, Sherm never had problems arriving at an opinion about a matter. He was pontifical and often brutal with the lawyers before him. Today he shook his mighty head as he read through the papers Robbie and McManus had filed.
"Where's your client?" he demanded of Jim.
With the bench elevated 6 feet over the well of the court, Crowthers appeared the size of Zeus. McManus was wordless as Sherm leered down at him.
"You want me to deny this motion, don't you, Mr. McManus?"
"Yes, sir," said McManus when he finally found his tongue.
"And the reason's 'cause your client believed he was speaking under the confidence of the attorney-client privilege to this lawyer from Foreland Supply. Isn't that what you're saying here in your papers?"
"Yes, sir."
"Am I going to take your word for that?"
"Sir."
"Am I supposed to let you tell me what your client thought, or is your client going to get up on the witness stand here in my courtroom and tell me for himself?"
Crowthers always took a particular glee in eluding attorneys' expectations. Practicing before him was a little like hitting a ball toward the front wall of a handball court without realizing that it could come back and smack you from behind.
"So where is your client?"
Crowthers demanded again. The matter was set over for 1 week to bring in Hardwick. McManus sent a teletype to D.C. to find an FBI special agent from out of town to play the executive, but UCork intervened. It was one thing for Robbie and Jim to make misleading statements to Crowthers and the other judges who were under investigation. The courts had long approved of that kind of governmental deception as part of an undercover operation. But an FBI agent, sworn on oath, claiming he was Royce Hardwick and testifying about events that had never happened, looked and smelled a lot like perjury. That was one of the reasons UCork's protocols had sought to avoid trials of the contrived matters. Both McManus and Sennett had to fly out to make a personal appearance at Maine Justice, and supposedly the decision to go forward was made by Janet Reno herself. In any case, on the morning of April 8th, a rock-jawed agent from somewhere in America was in McManus's office, prepared to play Royce Hardwick. Jim remained unnerved by his performance the week before and amazed at the primitive awe Crowthers was capable of inspiring with that murderous stare compressed beneath his graying brows. Robbie and Stan spent more time coaching McManus than our pseudo-Mr. Hardwick.
The agent was relaxed and seemed to understand his part, although he'd be less convincing if he was required to show Hardwick's seedy side. As they were all heading for court, Sennett pulled me into McManus's office.
Go with them.
I was incredulous.
You're the referring attorney, Stan said. It would make sense if you're there. And I'm worried about Jim with Sherm. We don't want people to start wondering if McManus is really a lawyer. If he needs some cues, it'll look less peculiar if they're not all coming from Robbie.
This was exactly the kind of thing I'd been afraid of. But Stan claimed the request had McManus's blessing, and Jim, in fact, repeated it. Crowthers was a lot to handle, even for courtroom veterans. And Robbie had no objections, so I tagged along, vowing to myself to do nothing unless there was a four-alarm fire. McManus had rehearsed the direct examination with the visiting agent at least a dozen times, and he was quite poised going through it. Royce Hardwick testified, according to his script, that he'd believed the Forland lawyer was there to act in his interests, and that he had figured what he'd told the lawyer was confidential. McManus tendered the witness for cross-examination, but Sherm never allowed Robbie to stand or Jim to get out of the way.
Not just a second here, Sherman demanded. You mind if I ask your client a couple questions, Mr. McManus?
Caught again in the headlights, Jim failed to answer, and Sherm flipped a dismissive hand in his direction. He could do pretty much as he liked on a matter like this.
Now listen here, Mr. Hardwick. You're telling me that when that lawyer from the company asked you what happened, you were thinking he was going to keep what you told him a secret?
Hardwick took his time with the question. His hands were folded on the shellacked birch rail of the witness stand, and he maintained an impressive executive timbre in answering yes.
So you must have told him the truth then, huh?
Caught short, Hardwick sat back. Sherm had scooted his chair all the way to the partition between the bench and the witness stand, but that apparently was not advantage enough. He now stood, looming 7 or 8 feet over Hardwick.
Heard me, didn't you? You wouldn't lie to your own lawyer, would you?
Well, Judge, I don't know.
You don't? You mean you'd send Mr. McManus here to tell lies to me?
Hardwick, who'd had to lean back to about 45 degrees to face Sherm, said, of course not.
No, said Sherm, and shook his huge head. I didn't think so. So if this lawyer's got some notes and memos about what you said had been passing between you and Olivia King, those things must be true, right?
Well, I don't really remember what happened back then anymore, Hardwick said, repeating the lines he'd rehearsed. My whole life fell apart. It's just a big jumble.
I've been hearing you say that. But you don't have any memory of lying to that lawyer, do you? That's what I'm asking you now. Did you lie, far as you remember?
Sherm put his hands on the partition and pushed his large face down toward Hardwick's, breaching a space between interlocutor and witness that he would have drawn and quartered any lawyer for violating. Hardwick actually let one arm rise up defensively before he said no.
That's what I'm saying. Of course you wouldn't lie. So if that lawyer says you admitted you were all worked up over Olivia King, that you'd been bothering her and pestering her, following her to work and calling her vile names in these letters, you were telling the truth, weren't you, best you remember?
Hardwick's eyes lit first on McManus, who still stood mute, then revolved past him as the witness searched the courtroom for help. I had some dwindling thought of passing Jim a note to tell him to object, but that only figured to inflame Crowthers more. Besides, I reminded myself, McManus was there to lose.
I guess, Hardwick finally answered.
Isn't any reason to think otherwise, right?
Right.
Okay, said Sherm, and finally beat his large head up and down.
With that, he returned his attention to McManus at the podium.
Okay. So what I'm trying to figure is what we all are doing here, Mr. McManus. Client just admitted on the record in this case same things he supposedly said in confidence to that lawyer, didn't he?
Sherman revealed his large, irregular teeth in a mischievous smile.
Nothing for me to rule on, is there? Doesn't matter whether the statements he made before are privileged, 'cause there's no way what he just said right here doesn't come into evidence, is there?
Sherman, when he laughed, let his tongue slide through his teeth, and he emitted a wet sputter under his heavy gray mustache. He enjoyed himself while his mean lesson sunk in around the courtroom. He'd obviously demanded McManus produce his client so he could batter a new set of admissions out of Hardwick, avoiding a difficult ruling in the process. Sennett, when he heard about this turn of events, was delighted. Talk about a judge on the take! But sitting there, I had no thought that corruption played any part in what Crowthers had done. It was just Sherm being himself, savoring the gratification he got by clobbering a jerk like Hardwick, and by demonstrating that the best attorney in the courtroom was the one up on the bench. As Sherm took his seat again, still chuckling and tossing his head in amusement, McManus came out with his only line of protest. "But, Your Honor," he said. Crowthers threw his big hand Jim's way, disregarding the objection, and went on drafting the order. We all left the courtroom together and climbed into an elevator where we were alone in the car. Robbie, who'd had the good sense not to speak a word during the hearing, finally piped up.
"But, Your Honor,"
he wailed just once. Hardwick had no comprehension what the laughter was about. Chapter 20. Favor joked that Even was working half days since she was with him every minute now, 6 a.m. to 6 at night, seeing him back and forth from his house. The Favor residence was English manor style, with a long shake roof and yellow stucco between the outer members of the upper story. The structure was surrounded by a crisp lawn and decorative landscaping, but it looked entirely out of place here, amid the prairie flatlands west of the city, where the only trees had been planted by gardeners a few years before. Glen Eyre, the suburb, was a former cornfield on which some developer had set down dozens of gigantic houses. Everyone here was like Robbie, rich and eager to show it. Huge luxury cars sat out in the driveways, and the alarming freakish shapes of satellite dishes reared up along the roof lines. The kids were obviously spoiled. You could tell just by the basketball standards the parents had driven into the earth beside the driveways, with cranks to raise and lower the rim and snappy acrylic backboards. The rich, to Even, were other people. She'd never envied much of what went with money. Merrill's husband, Roy, was a businessman, an MBA, who traveled all over the world and seemed to ship dollars home by the suitcaseful. But Even wasn't certain it had done her sister much good. Clubs and fashion, the competition to keep up, often seemed to have constricted Merrill's life. When Even climbed into the Mercedes each morning, Robbie was cheerful as a sunbeam. He zipped along, entertaining her with chatter, while she remained in the sullen funk of the sleep-deprived, still grieved that his circus act with Judge Medzik had cost her another hour in bed. Their first stop, a few miles in the wrong direction, was his mother's nursing home. While he was inside, Even read the paper. She pushed her seat back, reclined, took in the aroma of the leather. The engine ran, and she had the enormous, solid machine to herself. One morning, he decided to invite her inside.
"Hell, come on, you'll meet my ma."
It seemed unthinkable to him that she would have no interest. And she did, actually. She was curious about the woman who'd borne him. The result of Mrs. Favor's stroke last year was a nearly total hemiplegic paralysis. She had no use of her left leg and only marginal ability to move the arm on that side. But she still could speak, much as Robbie occasionally wished that weren't the case,
After therapy, she had no audible impairment. Mrs. Favor's home, the apartment in which Robbie had grown up, was a second-story walk-up which she'd had to abandon as a result of her disability. Robbie had wanted to take her into his house, but his mother, even in her weakened state, would hear none of it. He had enough on his hands with Lorraine. After much discussion, this nursing home seemed to be the best alternative. It cost him a left lung, he said, which made him feel a little better. Today, Estelle Favor sat upright in a padded day chair, dressed and ready for breakfast, which was still some time away. She held on to her heavy black-framed glasses with one hand, as if this might improve her vision, while she extended her neck turtle-like in the effort to follow the TV suspended on the opposite wall. Judging from the volume, her hearing, too, was failing. The utter immobility of her left side was apparent even from the doorway. Her arm hung down like wet laundry. She did not realize they had entered the room until Robbie was quite close to her. When she saw her son, she threw her right hand in the air, then recovered enough to whisk the glasses from her face and bury them in the folds of her skirt.
"Robbie!"
She fell into his arms and lifted the one good hand to his shoulder. She held him for quite some time until her cloudy, dark eyes found even. He introduced his new paralegal. To account for the fact that they were together so early in the morning, Robbie claimed they were heading to court. His mother's mouth went through a series of sour reflexes that signified disbelief, but she looked away rather than castigate her son for his antics. Robbie, as always, happily avoided unpleasantness.
"She looks great. Doesn't she look great?" he asked even.
Mrs. Favor, in fact, looked simply old. Her skin was engraved by heavy wrinkles which the thickly applied base and makeup did not really hide, and the chin beneath her neck hung in several folds that no doubt displeased her. It was clear she continued to take pains with her appearance. Even if Robbie had not told even that he engaged a manicurist and a stylist to come to the home weekly, it would have been plain. There was no missing the incredible orangutan orange of the hair dye or the popping red paint on her nails. They contrasted too pointedly, both with the glum surroundings and with her decrepitness. The bent spine, the pallid, spotted hands, the rattling cough. Looking at Mrs. Favor, even found it difficult even to say that she might once have been attractive. Her nose was hawkish, and her false teeth, on which some of her bright lipstick was smudged, seemed to have altered her jawline. But she was a force. You could feel that much. She brushed aside her son's compliments with a show of bashfulness.
"Well, it's just for him," Estelle said. "Who else sees me in this place?"
In his cheerleading fashion, Robbie again extolled the way his mother took care of herself, once more inviting even to chime in with praise of her own. She'd have been willing to flatter an old woman, although she'd never had much enthusiasm for ladies in war paint, the way they felt it was a female's responsibility to be so much more colorful, more glittering and glamorous than God and nature had made them. These days her own hair was barely combed. She was growing more perfunctory with her Elizabeth Arden makeup every morning, and she'd taken the color off her nails several weeks ago. But there proved no need to patronize. Mrs. Favor continued as if Robbie had not invited Even into their conversation. Even saw quickly that, at least as far as Mrs. Favor was concerned, no one really intruded on her relationship with her son. And in fact, as Robbie and his mother went on chortling over events here in the home, even realized that the same was true for him. They were so happy in each other's presence. Robbie tended to speak of his mother as if she were a drain, but it was his disinterest, his objectivity, that was feigned. The man was really a through-and-through fake. He was as clearly bound to her as she was to him. His litany of compliments, even, as her body failed, seemed sincere, a measure of the comfort he took in her physical presence. He held onto her hands as he questioned her about the doctor's latest report,
while his mother lingered contentedly in the hot light of his interest.
"Oh, the doctors, what do they know? You think you get Nobel Prize winners in here?"
She squinted at Ivan, her harsh voice reduced to a whisper.
"They're all foreigners. They're here for the Medicare. They give them, I don't know what, $6 for every old bag they glance at. They run through here like their pants are on fire. I can't even pronounce the names. Shadoopta, baboopta. God save me if I ever needed to call one. I'd just be dead."
Robbie received this speech, like everything else the old lady said, with great mirth. He hugged her again, and then, after further banter, motioned Ivan to go. To detain him, Mrs. Favor inquired after Lorraine.
"Eh,"
he answered.
"My son, his wife and his mother, one sicker than the other. Sometimes I'm alone, I cry for him. It's such a terrible thing. Who takes care of Robbie?"
He was jiggling the water pitcher throughout this speech, but he heard her apparently. He reminded her about Mort.
"He always sees the bright side," answered Mrs. Favor. "He makes jokes anyway. He's on the economy plan with hospital supply. My God!"
"Hey, shut up, will ya?" He leaned over and kissed her brow.
"So you'll come tomorrow?"
Mrs. Favor asked somewhat plaintively. "Wouldn't miss it for the world. End of the day. I got court in the morning." He waved, then shot down the hallway. Mrs. Favor watched his departure with dismay and did not respond when Ivan lingered at the threshold to say it had been a pleasure.